Okay, let's see. Okay. Any questions before or anything before we get started? Okay. Okay, now we're going to, I think we're going to discuss, I guess what we're going to try to deal with is we're going to discuss different kinds of classifiers, and then we're going to discuss using things like cross-validation and resampling to get estimates of the predictive accuracy of a classifier. And then we are going to discuss sort of sample size planning. So some classifiers, actually it turns out a lot of classifiers are linear classifiers. What they do is they're sort of weighted averages of the expression levels of different genes. They're either weighted averages of the log ratios or the log signals, where the signal is sort of the terminology from Affymetrix gene chips, and with different weights for the different genes, and with not all of the genes included in the classifiers, but there being some set F here in this notation of set of genes that were selected as being informative or differentially expressed among the classes that are being distinguished. And so that kind of a linear combination is going to just give you a number. Remember, the log ratios or the log signals, these are sort of continuous numbers. And so if we take a weighted average of them, we just get some quantity, and then we would need also some threshold. It's either above or below that threshold, and if it's above some threshold, we predict class 1. If it's below that threshold, we're going to predict class 2, something like that. And the issue is, you know, then there's going to be part of the algorithm will be, well, how do you select the weights, and how do you select the threshold? And there's actually a large variety of classification methods that are exactly of that type. They're exactly linear classifiers, and the only way they really differ is in the way they select their weights. One old statistical method of classification was called Fisher linear discriminant analysis, in which if you restrict analysis to a set of genes that were selected for including in your classifier, and then you can express that weight, those weights to be the vector of ones or twos or zeros of ones that are the class labels for the different classes of the samples times the inverse of the correlation matrix of those genes that were included. We're not going to go through the details here, just basically saying that Fisher linear discriminant analysis is sort of one kind of linear classifier. And it has sort of a very good pedigree, but you know, for some microarray problems, it's been found not to be so great because it requires you to estimate these correlations. And if you have too many genes included in your model relative to your number of cases, your estimates of the correlations are not very good. And so and it turns out then the classifier does not predict very well. There's another method that's very popular called diagonal linear discriminant analysis, which it just arbitrarily assumes that all of those intergene correlations are zero, and it winds up essentially just weighting things by the... This is wrong here. Y actually here is the difference in means between the two classes. This is wrong on this slide. Actually, I had a previous version of this slide. It had a D there, and I thought that was going to be confusing because we had a D there for the threshold. But what I wrote down Y is wrong. It actually should be the... Y should be the vector of difference in mean of the logs of either log ratios or log signals for the two classes, and because we have a weight for each gene, so it's not for each case. In the dimensions of this S matrix, S is a matrix of correlations among the genes, so it's number of genes by number of genes. Okay. So diagonal linear discriminant analysis automatically sets these, it's equivalent to Fisher linear discriminant analysis, but it sets the correlations arbitrarily zero, which you would think would be sort of a dumb thing to do. That you'd think you'd be better off taking into account which genes are correlated with each other. But it's sort of an example of when you're in an overfitting situation, sometimes it's better to do the dumb thing than to try to do the thing that is going to unfortunately require estimation of quantities that you just don't have enough data to estimate accurately. There's another thing I have a slide on a little bit later called the naive Bayes classifier, which is also a linear classifier. And Michael Radmaker in my group and some of the rest of us in the group developed several years ago a thing called the compound covariate predictor, which is very similar to diagonal linear discriminant analysis. And then there was a popular method that Todd Golub and his group developed called weighted voting method, which is also very similar to diagonal linear discriminant analysis. And for the compound covariate predictor, the weight is really just the difference in means between the two classes for gene, the ith gene, divided by a pooled estimate of the standard deviation, the within-class standard deviation for the ith gene. And whereas for the diagonal linear discriminant analysis, the weight actually winds up to be, instead of dividing by that standard deviation, you divide by its square. Support vector machines with sort of an inner product kernel are just linear classifiers with the weights determined in a different way. It's sort of almost equivalent to a thing in statistics called ridge regression, where you try to separate the classes, but to do it in a way that does not give you any very large regression coefficients. And so it tries to find the hyperplane between, I guess I spelled plane wrong here, P-L-A-N-E, that minimizes the length of the weight vector. So there are other kinds of support vector machines based on other things, but actually there have been some studies that find these linear support vector machines do actually better than the more complicated ones because of the potential for data overfitting. But it's interesting to see they are just linear classifiers. But they do have actually a good theoretical basis. I won't go through the details, but basically you're trying to separate the classes, determine a weight vector that separates the classes in a way that minimizes the sum of squares of the weights. There was a publication of a neural network classifier, a perceptron, but a perceptron, it turns out, is really just a linear classifier. It's a neural network with no hidden layer and sort of linear transfer functions. And it's really nothing but a linear classifier. Now, the naive Bayes classifier, the idea is you assume for each of the classes that the expression profiles are multivariate normal and that they have the same covariance matrix in the two classes. And if you just apply Bayes' theorem to get the posterior probability that your case is in class 1 or class 2, given its expression profile, it just involves those something that's really essentially the same as what the diagonal linear discriminant analysis does, uses weighted by a prior probability that the cases are in the relative probability of the cases are in class 1 or class 2. So it's like diagonal linear discriminant analysis, except it does permit you to take into account, for example, that maybe you have five times as many non-responders as you do responders, and that that can be used as in your classification in addition to your expression values. It's a kind of classifier that has been used for a long time, and it was called naive Bayes because it was for situations where you had a bunch of predictors and you didn't have enough data to take into account their correlations. And so you used diagonal covariance matrix estimates. And so that was always thought to be sort of naive, except a number of studies have found that these methods actually do pretty well. And so same thing has been found for diagonal linear discriminant analysis. So it's essentially the same as diagonal linear discriminant analysis. With the compound covariate classifier, you can make that into a Bayesian kind of classifier, too. The compound covariate classifier that I was mentioning, it turns out it's sort of, remember, a linear combination of the expression levels of different genes, where the weights, it turns out, are like the t-statistics for measuring differential expression between the two classes for those genes, and you restrict the sum to those genes that are selected as being differentially expressed. And if you think about it, what that gives you, it's a linear combination of the expression levels of some selected genes, a weighted linear combination. And so you can just think of that as sort of some metagene expression level. It's sort of, and you can think of it as just a scalar. So now you've reduced all of these expression levels for the different genes to the expression level of one gene, which we'll call the compound covariate. And it's then a measure that you have on each of your cases and something that you can compute for a future case where the t-statistics, the gene selection and the t-statistics were computed on your current data, and then you would just apply that to your future case for which you want a prediction on. But you could think of it as a dimensionality reduction to get you down to one dimension. And then you can proceed as for the naive Bayes classifier, but just for this single metagene, the single compound covariate, you could assume that that is normally distributed in the two classes, different mean in the two classes. It has doesn't even have to have the same variance in the two classes. And there's no correlations to worry about. You've already reduced it just to one gene, and you can get a posterior probability that a given future case is in class 1 or class 2. And this was published by George Wright in my group in a PNAS article that I believe is on the website. The other thing you can show is that when the number of candidate genes is greater than the number of cases, it's almost always possible to find a linear classifier that gives you perfect separation of the class 1 and class 2 samples on your whatever your data set is. So it sort of raises the issue of, well, if there's always some linear classifier that will perfectly classify your data set, do you really have enough information in that data set to be fitting nonlinear classifiers? It doesn't really give you an answer to that question, because in some cases you could say, well, with a nonlinear classifier, maybe I would be capturing some essence in the data that is the real essence, and maybe it would predict better. But it does raise this question, and I think it's interesting to realize that with the linear classifiers, you can always fit. It also raises the issue that if you can always find a linear classifier that perfectly distinguishes the cases in your data set, that just the fact that it perfectly distinguishes the cases in your data set is not a very good indication that that classifier is going to do very well with independent data. So it reinforces what we've been talking about before, is that somehow you have to separate the data set, the part of the data that you use for fitting your classifier, from the part of the data that you're going to use for evaluating, giving you an estimate of how accurate it's going to be for the future.
So my question relates to that. Most of these you're comparing two classes. What is the reality that your data actually falls nicely into two classes? I mean, if you're considering patient data, for instance, you know, you have the normals, which is quite variant, and you have the patients, which to some classification from clinical data, you can sort them into, I for sure consider this one group. But in reality, by my array, they may not be a very strong.
Okay, no, no, no.
They may divide or...
Yeah, no, no. The class definition should come from what it is you want to accomplish. It shouldn't come from anything about how similar or different the expression profiles are. In other words, the class definition is defined by what your objectives are. Your objectives to distinguish normal from disease tissue of this particular type of tissue, or are your objectives to distinguish responders to non-responders? It's not like, well, I've done arrays on all the specimens that I had access to.
Yeah, no, I'm not even going to that point, because there are a lot that you can separate clinically, or as you mentioned earlier, all the different possibilities. But even though clinically they all look like they should fit into one group, in reality, you know, there's going to be outliers. So will a lot of these classifiers be able to tell you, yes, this fits into class one with this significance, or I'm not sure.
So you have to.
And it will fit into class two, or it really doesn't fit into either group. Will a lot of these classifiers be able to give you that level of information?
Your objective is not to figure out which group a given sample is in. Your objective is to develop a classifier that permits you to make a prediction for the future that you want to make. it's not to sort of group your existing samples, specimens, into groups.
Well, the existing data set that you use to determine the predictor, right?
But
so you really have to be extremely focused on the data, the samples that you're using, and try and find...
You have to be focused on what question... You have to be very clear on the question you want to ask, you're asking.
And although you need large number of replicas, you want to try and make sure that they're very identical.
No. If you're trying to ask a question of distinguishing certain classes, you want your samples to be representative of those classes.
But within that class, you want each class to be very...
Well, if you pick your samples to be very homogeneous, and in fact your classes are not homogeneous, then the classifier you develop probably won't work very well in the future. So that's why you want to pick your samples to be representative of the classes that you're really trying to distinguish for future prediction.
Is there a way of going through and looking at the, determining the classifier? You use particular subsets of your data, so then you have another subset that you can go
okay.
and use the predictor? In watching, as you change what that initial subset is,
yeah.
you may see your predictor, am I using that right? The predictor change over time. And maybe that way be able to see some outliers in your group that...
Well, you know, I think in any of these problems, you have some class. You want to predict, is it in this class or is it in that class? And the class is defined separately from your expression data. The class has to be defined. It's something, you're trying to develop a predictor, but in defining your classes, you don't want to be looking at your expression data. Now, you may find when you develop a predictor that it predicts pretty well, but there are a few that it missed. And then you might start thinking, well, gee, are they really, is there something unusual about those? Or maybe, it is certainly true that, if you do, it may be that the way you've defined your classes, like you say, are too broad. Mm-hmm. They may be too broad to get good prediction. And then
clinically, they all look the same, but once you really go in and look at finer details,
they're
not really.
Yeah. Although if you really want to be looking at I was involved in one study early on where we had a bunch of melanoma specimens, expression profiles from human melanoma, and our objective really was to say, are these tumors homogeneous, or are they really heterogeneous? It's just that we haven't known the basis of the heterogeneity previously, and there was really nothing we wanted to. There were no classes that we really wanted to correlate things to. There were no good responders and bad responders. They were basically all bad responders. So it wasn't that we had something that we were trying to, classes we were trying to distinguish, but we just wanted to know, were these homogeneous from an expression profile point of view? And so we didn't take that as a class prediction or class comparison problem. We took that as a clustering problem, a class discovery problem. Where we basically just clustered the expression profiles for the different samples and then tried to say, do we really have distinct clusters? And that in itself is a little bit of a hard question to answer, because when you run a cluster analysis, you always get clusters, right? So it's a question of, are these distinct enough? Are they more distinct than what you would just sort of get if there were no real distinct samples? So we worked on that problem for a while. But basically, that was sort of more in line, I think, with what you were saying. But it was, there are certain problems that are, you're not trying to predict pre-existing classes. You're really trying to just sort of be descriptive in saying, well, based on these expression profiles, do they look like they're that they're just different groups here? And then once you see that maybe there are those different groups, you know, then you can say, well, how does this grouping relate to the various kinds of characteristics we have about the samples? And that's a different approach, and you know, that is sometimes, you know, the right approach.
Well, I have one quickie expansion on your first bullet there. So it's always possible to find a set of features and a weight vector for which the error of classification in a given data set will be zero. That doesn't surprise me if you have 20,000 things to pick from and you've got maybe five in this group and five in that group
right.
or something. And so one way to think about that is that's the linear, and you talked about a number of different linear methods here that are all linear combinations. So if I picked a set of features that look pretty different between these two groups, then it's probably true that I could pick a whole bunch of different sets of weight vectors
exactly.
that would perfectly discriminate between these groups.
Exactly.
And some among those sets of weight vectors would map to one of these particular methods.
Right.
So there must be really quite an infinite number of linear classifier methods
That's right.
yet to be discovered and published. And
That's right.
So it seems to me that this sort of an exercise is like a tough nut to pick amongst these linear classifiers with this kind of a data structure when we have this.
Well, okay, no, not quite though, because I think what it really tells us though is that in evaluating whether how good any one of them are, we have to somehow, so what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to use one data set. Suppose I come up with some algorithm for a linear classifier, a new kind of linear classifier, okay? And to evaluate it, it's not going to be too good if I just apply it to any of these data sets with 20,000 genes in it. Exactly. Or I take an existing data set and I split it into two parts, apply my algorithm to one part, and then see how does it actually predict in the other part. So that's what. And you're right that there's not just one classifier, there's an infinite number of them, linear classifiers. The only time this is not hold is if there's inconsistencies in the data. You have essentially the same expression profile. You have two samples with the same expression profile, one of which is in class 1, one of which is in class 2, then obviously you can't separate it. But except for situations like that, or linear combinations of things like, of inconsistencies, that always holds. So there is this, basically people haven't gone to publishing infinite numbers of linear classifiers that there's a huge literature on complicated nonlinear classifiers, I guess a lot of people, some people find that, well, by using complicated classifiers and it looks more like artificial intelligence, and they're more likely to get some naive set of reviewers to accept their paper for a very high-profile journal. So artificial intelligence sells to journal reviewers and peers who can't distinguish hype from substance, but the comparative and there haven't been enough comparative studies, but the comparative studies that have been done have generally shown that the simpler methods work as well or better because they avoid so much overfitting the data. What are some of the other simpler, relatively simple methods other than the linear methods? Well, the nearest neighbor kind of methods, or nearest centroid methods. And so here's what nearest neighbor is. To classify a sample in the validations, so basically the idea is we have some training set of data, and some of the samples are in class 1 and some of the samples are in class 2, and based on this training set of data we figure out which genes we want to use in our classifier. And now we have some sample from our validation set that was not used in our training set to select the genes. And to classify that sample in the validation set, we determine which sample in the training set its gene expression profile is most similar to. And the similarity measure, or the distance measure used, is based on the genes that were selected in this training set as being informative for distinguishing these classes. And then there's a couple of similarity or distance metrics that are widely used to sort of compare similarities of vectors of expression levels for different genes. And so the correlation measure or the Euclidean distance measure. So you take this sample that you want to classify, and you just sort of look at the expression levels for the genes that were determined for this training set as being the informative genes. And then you try to find the element of the training set. You try to find the sample that is as similar as possible to this one you want to classify. And what you do is you classify the one to be the same class as the one its vector is most similar to. And that's called nearest neighbor classification. And it's sort of neat. It does depend on predefining some kind of a similarity measure or a distance measure, and it does depend on selecting genes. But other than that, there's no parameters to estimate. And there's a variety of variants of this. There's one called a k-nearest neighbor, whereas instead of just finding the single sample that this thing is most similar, find, say, the three samples that it's most similar to. The one it's most similar to, the one it's second most similar to, and the one it's third most similar to. And then take each of those three things are in either class one and class two, and you take a majority vote as to which class it is. And in fact, this kind of a method is not just restricted to two classes. You could use this same kind of idea with however many classes you have. Another variant is called nearest centroid classifier. And the centroid is nothing but in other words, if you look at your training set and you have these specimens in your training set, and look at all of the ones that are in class one, and take the average expression level for gene 1, the average expression level for gene 2, the average expression level for gene 3. That vector of averages averaged for the specimens in class 1 is called the centroid for class 1. And similarly, you'll have a centroid for class 2 and a centroid for class 3. So each one of those centroids is a vector of gene expression levels averaged over the samples in that class. And then when you have a new thing to classify, you say which of those centroids is it most similar to, using your similarity metric, either correlation or Euclidean distance, and then you classify it according to that. And BRBRA tools are the basic BRBRA tools class prediction tool has all of these things, and in fact it gives you the results in just multiple columns, so you can usually just look right down one table and see whether any of these methods are doing any better than any other methods. And there's a couple of the more complicated methods that are in separate tools, and so you don't really get them in the same table, but you get nearest neighbor, three nearest neighbor, nearest centroid, diagonal linear discriminant analysis, compound covariate predictor, and linear support vector machines all in the one table.
Do you need a standard, say, when you calculate Euclidean distance, do you need to standardize your data? Otherwise, like the genes with high intensity will contribute more?
Yes, I think that probably with log ratios it would be okay. I think you're right, with single...
even with the log ratio, there are quite different variations like from the... it's better, but...
Yeah, it's less of a problem. I think you're right. I think with single label arrays like Affymetrix gene chips, you could have... even with correlation, it could still dominate it. And so it probably would be best to standardize your data. There's a lot of other methods that I'm not mentioning here. There's neural network methods that are other than perceptrons. There's this method I mentioned called top scoring pairs that tries to find pairs that work together. CART is sort of a decision tree method. Decision trees are very appealing in the sense of it says, you know, they tell you things like they would give you a classification. Well, if gene 327 is above such and such a level, then it's class 1. If it's below that level, then you look at some other gene, until you work your way down the decision tree, and then at the bottom of the decision tree, at each terminal node of the decision tree, it gives you a prediction of which class you're in. And the reason they're sort of appealing is they're very interpretable, more interpretable than some linear combination of gene expression levels. They generally do not work well for microarray problems because they're sort of fitting all combinations of genes. They're fitting all of these interactions, and they just overfit the data badly. So there's lots of experience that say that single decision trees is one of the worst things you can do. There is this method called random forest, developed by Leo Breiman, that doesn't fit a single decision tree. It fits a whole bunch of decision trees, what he calls a forest of decision trees. And then what you do is, if you have a new thing to classify, you classify it by each of these 100 decision trees in your forest, and then you take a vote among those 100 decision trees, and the class that gets the most votes is the one. To me, according to Breiman, it works very well, but to me it seems to give up what was really the defining attraction of decision trees, and that is that they're interpretable. I don't think forests are interpretable. And then there are, like I say, genetic algorithm-based classification, where these are just... I tend to think of the classification algorithm as being the whole thing, including the feature selection thing, too. And so usually what genetic algorithms are, where you roll the feature selection together with the classifier fitting, but you then look for sets of features that classify well together. There's a variety of methods that I would call apparent dimension reduction based methods. Some of them are actual dimension reduction based methods. One of them is principal component regression, and that is it really is a dimension reduction based method, and that is where rather than doing anything with regard to the individual genes, you start off by reducing maybe your 20,000 genes to 10 metagenes, each one being a linear combination of your original genes. And in doing this calculation, you don't use the class information at all. You just define the principal components are defined as the linear combinations that have the largest variation, largest variance among all of your samples, where the variance is calculated without using the class identifiers at all. And so the linear combinations that are sort of orthogonal to each other that have the largest variation. And so it really does reduce your problem to a much smaller dimensional problem. There are two problems with the approach. One is there's no particular reason to believe that those principal components are going to be good predictors. They were developed they maximize your variation among the samples, which may just mean they're hard to assay. You know, may mean something else. May mean that these are genes that really do have a lot of variation among the samples. I mean, genes that do have a lot of variation among the samples can be useful. It really depends on how much between class differences compared to within class variation, but that's not how principal components are collected. So you don't know, just because they're principal components, you don't know whether any of them are going to be particularly good. And the second thing is they're not interpretable. You know, it's a linear combination of 20,000 things. And so there are methods that people have developed to try to figure out which, you know, to sort of interpret which of the genes have the greatest, loadings for each of the principal components. And there's a method called gene shaving, where you try to make them principal components of smaller numbers of genes. You set to zero the loadings that are small. But basically, they're not really interpretable. And then there's a method called supervised principal components, where first of all you start by finding which genes are differentially expressed between your classes, and then you just calculate the principal components of those. So you may start out with 20,000 genes, you may find 100 of them or 200 of them that are differentially expressed between your classes at some level, some significance level. And then you calculate the 10 principal components of those, and you use those principal components in your classifier. And that method has been found to work pretty well in some cases. And there are other methods, another method called partial least squares. It works pretty much the same as supervised principal components, about as well. It's in theory a little different. And then, of course, there's stepwise logistic regression. You could, rather than just looking at the genes that seem to predict univariately, that seem to be differentially expressed between your classes univariately, you could pick the gene which gives you the best discrimination between the classes and then step up from there. Okay, now, given that I've picked that gene, what's the next gene that will add most to that? And you wind up with models there that, with smaller number of genes, but what I've seen, those methods do not work any better than any other methods, the stepwise logistic regression. I have seen what was mentioned this morning from support vector machines with recursive elimination. I've seen several comments that works pretty well. I haven't tried that, and I'll be looking forward to trying that. Now, when there are more than two classes, like I say, you can use nearest neighbor type methods. And there's another method that's also implemented in BRBRA tools, which is sort of a decision tree of binary classifiers. And so suppose we have K classes to be, and we want to predict for a new sample which of these K classes, and I, I was involved in a project where these were K different types of lymphoma, and we wanted to have expression profiles that distinguished these types. And so the way you do it is, this is one way of doing it. I mean, one way of doing it is just to do a nearest neighbor type of classifier. The problem with the nearest neighbor type of classifier, well, I don't know that there's any problem. I think that's generally a good way, and it's easy, and it's worth trying. This is just a different way of doing it. I guess there is one problem with the nearest neighbor classifier that I was going to say is, remember, for the nearest neighbor classifier, you need two things. You need a set of genes, and you need some sort of a similarity or distance metric. And no problem with selecting a similarity or distance metric, but how are you going to select your genes? Well, if you only have two classes, it's pretty clear you select the genes that distinguish those two classes. If you have three classes, it's not so clear. And so the one way of doing it is to say, well, yeah, I'll do an F, instead of doing a T test to identify genes that distinguish the two classes, I'll do an F test. And the F test tests whether the means for those three classes for that gene, all those means are equal. And so the F test then would pick up the genes that are in some way different between those three classes. And so you could pick up which genes to include in calculating your similarity metric using that kind of thing, but it wouldn't be optimized. That set of genes wouldn't be optimized for any particular decision problem. And so this decision tree of binary classifiers is sort of an attempt to sort of optimize the gene selection better. And so the way it works is, we started off with K classes. And so how are we going to, what decision are we going to make first? Well, we could decide, okay, I'm going to try to distinguish class one from the other classes mixed together, right? Or class two from the other K minus one classes mixed together. I could sort of, you know, there's each of those singleton things, singleton versus everything else mixed together. I could define that as a binary decision problem. Or I could say, maybe I want to combine class one and two and try to distinguish those from classes two, three, and four. So there's lots of ways to do it. So the way we've done it in BWA tools is we start off just partitioning this set of K things into two disjoint sets. What that means is S1 is some subset of the K classes, and S2 is a remaining subset. So each of the classes is in one of these things, S1 or S2, and all of the classes are in one or the other, and no classes in both of them. That's what a partition is. And what we actually wind up doing is we look at all possible partitions into two sets. But suppose we just arbitrarily pick some partition, S1 and S2, and then we develop a binary classifier for distinguishing this composite classes in S1 from the composite classes in S2. And we calculate the cross-validated classification error for distinguishing S1 from S2. And then I repeat that what I just did for all possible partitions, S1 and S2, to find the partition for which the cross-validated classification error is minimized. So I'm finding the way of grouping the classes into two groups in such a way that I think I can best solve that binary decision problem. And the way I'm judging best is by I'm going to have some kind of a cross-validated procedure for giving the prediction accuracy of distinguishing S1 from S2. And that's going to, and so I'm going to take that as my top node of the tree. So my top node of the tree will be, I'm going to group classes, whatever they are, a bunch of classes into S1, the remaining classes into S2, and I'm going to develop a binary classifier. I'm going to select genes for making that distinction. And then I'm just going to repeat that whole procedure now separately for S1, and then I'm going to repeat it completely separately for the classes in S2, and just continue working my way down the tree until what I have at the bottom is just a bunch of single nodes, nodes consisting of singleton classes. So now I've got everything classified. And so it's, each node is not a gene. Each node is a binary classifier distinguishing sets of genes, sets of classes.
One point of clarification. So when you're developing these classifiers, you're using all the genes, just in the classical.
I develop a classifier by selecting the genes. And the genes I select for distinguishing the two groups at the top don't have to be the same genes I select.
I guess I'm not clear. Then we have two steps here. I thought feature selection might be one thing, and then classifier development.
Well,
what I'm saying is which genes you're going to think about and what weights you're going to choose.
Okay, well, I'm going to do that. I'm going to repeat that at each node of the tree. At each node of the tree, I'm going to reselect the genes.
So you're going to select your features or something?
I'm talking about features and genes, the same, the same thing. Yeah, I'm going to redo that because, like at the top node, the binary comparison I'm trying to make, this set of classes from that set of classes, the genes I might use to distinguish those. In other words, suppose I have three classes. Let's just simplify it a little bit. And so at the very top of the tree, I'm going to consider three different kinds of binary problems. One is distinguishing one, class one, from the merger of classes two and three, or distinguishing class two from the merger of classes one and three, or distinguishing class three from the merger of classes one and two. For each of those three problems, I am going to develop a binary classifier with its own optimally selected genes. And I'm going to measure how good each of those classifiers are by doing some kind of a cross-validation. And maybe I find that if I try to distinguish class one, suppose classes two and three are really quite similar, but they're very different from class one. So if I try to distinguish one and two merged together from three, my cross-validation procedure should tell me I can only do that with a lot of errors, because those two, because the mixture of one and two, is going to have a lot of overlap in gene expression with the samples in class three. So when I try to develop, even if I select the best genes for making that distinction, if I do my cross-validation right, I'm probably going to get a substantial number of cross-validation errors. Whereas when I build my classifier distinguishing one from two and three, if two and three are very similar, if I build my classifier distinguishing one from two and three, I should be able to select a set of genes and build a classifier, and my cross-validation estimate of prediction accuracy should have very few errors in it. And so probably what will happen in this situation is at the first step, it'll tell me what you really want to do is you want to distinguish class one from the mixture of classes two and three. And I will have a binary classifier with a set of genes for doing that. That's the that's what I'll have when I finish with that.
Well, I understand the tree scheme, but what I was trying to get at was that it sounds like we have a two-step procedure. We're going to select a set of features, and then we're going to select a set of weights. But if you, as you talked about the classifiers before that, we weren't really distinguishing those two processes. For example, if I took all of the genes and found a set of weights, some of those weights are going to be with an epsilon of zero. And so maybe I can just throw those genes out. I mean, so
well, usually,
weight selection is some aspect of feature selection if I want to specify a threshold.
Yeah, although the way it's very frequently done is you do...
Okay, that's what I wanted to clarify.
The way it's very, even with two classes, the way it's very frequently done is you do the gene selection... And then you only fit the weights to that. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't make that clear enough. So you'll have a completely different classifier with different genes at each node on the tree. And when you talk about cross-validation, you really should cross-validate this whole process. In other words, what we do in BRB Array Tools, in addition to considering all partitions at each node, partitions of groupings of classes, we also provide the option of doing a complete cross-validation. And that is, you leave out maybe 10% of your samples, you do this entire tree-building process, and then you, for those 10% you left out, you classify them. And then you leave a different 10% out and you repeat this entire... So each time you repeat the tree building process, you may get a different structure of the tree.
Okay. And how do you finalize that structure?
Okay. Good question. It's the same question sort of comes up actually almost with any classifier. We're jumping ahead a little bit because we're talking a lot about cross-validation, but... With cross-validation, what happens is also you leave out either 10% of your class of your samples, or you leave out one sample at a time. And as we'll talk about very shortly now, then you rebuild a classifier, redetermine your genes totally from scratch. And so when you if you're doing that 10 times, leaving out 10% each time, it's sort of you have 10 different classifiers. What I feel is what you're really doing is for the future, you are going to build a classifier using all of your data. You're not going to leave anything out. But the reason you go through this exercise of leaving things out is because you want to get an estimate of the predictive accuracy of this classifier that you build using all of your data. And the only way you can really get anything close to an unbiased estimate of that classifier is by going through this rigmarole in which you leave things out and build it. But those classifiers are in themselves not to be touched. They're not; those classifiers are just sort of working data. You know, those sort of... It's just part of the rigmarole you go through, but what you're really trying to do is develop a proper estimate of prediction accuracy of the classifier you use. So what some people do, which is a problem, is they say, well, I've gone through all this cross-validation stuff, and now I can see that, well, when I build all of these classifiers, some of the genes are used almost all the time. Some of them are only used in 50% of these classifiers. I would like to use that information in determining which genes to actually use for the classifier I build for the future. Well, you've got a problem. If you use that information, you now have a new algorithm for building a classifier, because using that information means... That's part of your algorithm. Now you're going to say, well, I'm only going to use the genes that appeared in 80% of my cross-validated training sets. Well, now you have a totally new algorithm. And if you really are going to apply that algorithm to your full data set, which is okay, you no longer have a proper estimate of the classification accuracy of that algorithm. So whatever your algorithm is that you're going to carry forward, if it involves using cross-validated stuff, whatever it is, you have to apply that entire algorithm from scratch at each cycle of your cross-validation. And so if your algorithm says, well, I want to count up what percentage of the time the genes occur in these cross-validated training sets, well, that means really that algorithm, in order to evaluate the performance of that algorithm, you have to embed that algorithm in each step of your cross-validation. Since that algorithm itself involves cross-validation, you're going to have a nested cross-validation embedded within each outer cross-validation. Okay. I think I'll skip this. This is just there's a couple of good papers by Sandrine Dudoit evaluating different kinds of classifiers. I think her first original one, and I believe these are both with Terry Speed, appeared in Journal of the American Statistical Association, and the second one is in a chapter in Terry Speed, the book he edited on microarrays. And it's a very nice, pretty comprehensive evaluation of a bunch of different kinds of classifiers. And this one, this FLDA was Fisher Linear Discriminant Analysis, and the DLDA is Diagonal Linear Discriminant Analysis, and the GOLLAB is this weighted voting method, which is also just a linear classifier. The DQDA is Diagonal Quadratic. And then for classification trees, I think the first column was just a single classification tree. I'm not sure, but I think so. And the other ones involved combinations of decision trees. And then the last one was, I think, nearest neighbor. And I think what the table shows is a bunch of the number of errors in each of these, I think in cross-validating a bunch of different sets. And I guess the only point really to note is you don't see too many cases where anything does better than diagonal linear discriminant analysis or nearest neighbor. Fisher linear discriminant analysis generally does worse than diagonal linear discriminant analysis. In this case, I guess what's a single decision tree doesn't do too badly, but it does worse than diagonal linear discriminant analysis or usually nearest neighbor. The bottom line, I think, of that finding was just that diagonal linear discriminant analysis and nearest neighbor do pretty well. Right. I mean, if you get down, if you wind up using only a very small number of genes, then you probably can model it, and it probably works okay, maybe work better. But if you have too many genes, then it doesn't work too well. There was a quote, I used to think this quote was from Dan Quayle, "Prediction is difficult, especially the future." But actually, it was from Niels Bohr, so... and anyway, we've talked about this before. So evaluating a classifier, as we've said, the fit of the model to the same data used to develop it isn't really adequate evaluation of prediction accuracy, and demonstrating statistical significance really isn't the same as demonstrating predictive accuracy. And also, demonstrating stability of identification of gene predictors in different studies is not the same as demonstrating predictive accuracy. What you see a lot in the literature are editorials saying, or papers saying, well, we had these three studies of prognostic, you know, predictive factors in breast cancer, and there was very little overlap in the genes identified in these studies as prognostic, and therefore there must be something wrong. And the point is that the fact that different studies come up with different genes that's not the same as saying, really, if you want to say, if somebody develops a predictor, and you want to know, is that predictor robust? Does it work for other sets of data? What you want to do is take other sets of data and predict, not see whether those other sets of data give rise to the same genes. There's lots of reasons why there might not be very much overlap in the genes that different studies come up with. One of the reasons is there's a lot of genes that are highly correlated with each other. And so sometimes and what you do with many of these classifiers is you use fairly stringent sort of levels for selecting genes. And so for any particular gene, the power for selecting that gene is probably not very high. And so sometimes you may select that gene, sometimes you may select a gene that it's correlated with, but is not the same gene. And so that's certainly one reason why different studies may come up with very different gene sets. But that is really not an indicator that there's anything wrong. Really, if you want to evaluate, it's important to evaluate predictiveness for independent data, but you have to do it directly. One way to do it, a lot of times when you're really trying to do that, you find, well, they didn't use the same array as we did, and so how can I apply my predictor to that set of data? And so you have to go through some sort of procedure where you say, well, okay, in my predictor, what genes were here, what genes did they measure? Of those, which ones did they measure on their array? And then you say, okay, well, now I've got this classifier, but only some of the genes were measured, so how do I apply it on their array? Well, one way to do it is to take your set of genes, and without trying to apply your classifier directly to another set of data, just take the set of genes that you wound up selecting and one thing you can do is cluster that set of data with regard to using some distance metric, but restrict it to that set of genes that you got from your study, and then to see whether those clusters distinguish their cases with regard to the outcome that you're trying to predict. You can do other things like taking your set of genes and doing a cross-validated nearest neighbor kind of classifier using that set of genes. Or you can define a nearest neighbor classifier with your set of genes and apply their data to that using only the genes that were measured of your set that were measured on their array. Trying to do things that restricting it to things like nearest neighbor or clustering to try to see whether there's carryover, whether those genes carry the power for an independent set of data of distinguishing the classes. As we were talking at lunch, when you try to apply your classifier to some independent set of data, there may be some very sticky problems in normalizing the things relative to each other and some kind of calibration difficulties between the different arrays. So the classification algorithms include, as we've talked about, determining what kind of classifier to use, gene selection, fitting parameters, and optimizing with regard to tuning parameters. Well, what do I mean by tuning parameters? Well, for example, when I talked about gene selection, I said, well, we might select the genes to be included in our classifier as those for which the, if we have two classes that, that distinguish those two classes at a p-value of less than 0.01, you know, right? So I assumed we had some threshold to apply by using gene selection. And that's a tuning parameter. I don't really know what level of that threshold to use. And somehow in the process, I may need to, in other words, so what people do sometimes is they say, well, I'm going to develop classifiers for a bunch of different values of this tuning parameter, and I'm going to use cross-validation, and I'm going to try to see which of those classifiers has the lowest cross-validation error, and then that's the value of the tuning parameter I'll use. And so that is what I'm calling optimizing with regard to tuning parameters, and that is actually best thought of as part of your classifier algorithm, the setting of the tuning parameter. That is part of what needs to be embedded within the cross-validation. So if a resampling method such as cross-validation is to be used to estimate the predictive error of a classifier, all aspects of the classification algorithm must be repeated for each training set, and the accuracy of the resulting classifier is scored on the corresponding validation set. So if gene selection, you know, is generally part of developing a classifier, so that needs to be repeated for each training set, and similarly optimizing with regard to a tuning parameter. Okay, so the simplest kind of evaluation in which we're separating the data used for fitting for developing the classifier from the data used for evaluating it is what's called a split sample evaluation, where you have your set of data and you separate it out into a training set of samples and a testing set of samples. So sometimes it's called a learning set and a test set, or learning set and a validation set. Within the training set, you do everything you need to do for building this classifier. And you can do whatever you want. But what you can't do is use the samples in the test set in any way, shape, or form for any purpose. And ideally, what you want to do is when you have one classifier, when you have one predictive model, not one based on 0.05 and one based on 0.01 and another one based on 0.005 and another one based on 0.001. But when you have one and you want to evaluate how well that one does, then and only then do you go to your test set. And it's withheld until a single model is fully specified using the training set. And all cutoff levels, all everything should be specified in the training set. And so this fully specified model is applied to the expression profiles in the test set to predict the class labels in the test set. And you just count up the number of errors. And now, how do you do the split between the training set and the test set? Usually it's done sort of randomly, but you could have the test set, you could do it, you could actually, some people, if they have a multi-center study, they try to balance the training set and the test set to have samples from all of the centers in both of them. Others would say, well, that's exactly what you don't want to do. If you really want to have it simulate independent prediction for the future, then your test set should consist of samples from centers that are different from the centers that you used for building your model. Similarly, if the assays were done at different points in time, because as was commented previously, in real-world application of a classifier, you're going to have lots of sources of variation, including you're not going to be able to do all of the assays in one, well, you may be able to do them in one lab, but probably not at one point in time, the way you may have done your research study. And so, you know, you may try to incorporate this split sample thing to simulate the real world future as much as possible. A lot of people don't want that much reality testing so early in the game, but now as we'll go on a little bit, we'll say that it turns out this is not the most efficient use of the data to this split sample thing in order to get an evaluation. We'll get into things like cross-validation, bootstrap resampling. Some of these things represent a more efficient use of the data in terms of getting estimates of prediction accuracy. But all of those kind of things involve redeveloping classifiers for different subsets of the data, right? Depending on which cases you leave out. And in some big studies, what you do for developing your classifier is not determined by any algorithm. You know, it's, you may try lots of things. You may use biological, you know, meaningfulness in terms of, as a criteria for which genes you want to include. You may have, I've been involved in studies where we've had multiple groups analyzing the data, and kinds of things we can't do for every loop of a cross-validation. And so for those kinds of studies where you have some complexity in terms of the developing of your classifiers, either because multiple groups are developing classifiers and you're going to have to get together and decide which to use, or just because you're trying to bring biological interpretation more into it, you know, there's still a role for the split sample evaluation, particularly in large studies. Leave one out cross-validation. The idea is, so you omit sample one, you develop your classifier from scratch under training set with all of the other samples, but not with sample one in it. And once you have that fully developed classifier, you predict the class for sample one, and you record whether that prediction was correct or not. And then you do the same thing, leaving out each of the samples one at a time, developing a classifier from scratch for each of these training sets consisting of n minus one samples. And so you really wind up with n different classifiers. They may involve, generally will involve n different sets of genes, but you're doing it again for the purpose of trying to get an estimate of the prediction error of the classifier that you fit to the full data set. And this is your estimate. You're basically adding up the number of errors that you got from these N classifiers. Each one fitted omitting a sample and then predicting for that sample left out. So as you can see, it sounds right. I mean, intuitively, you could say it sounds right or it sounds wrong. It sounds right in the sense that each time you are predicting, you are developing a classifier, and you're not using anything, any information from that one that was left out. And then you're just predicting for the one that was left out, and you're just counting up whether you got it right or wrong. And then you're just redoing that n times and adding them all up. So intuitively, it sounds like that should be valid. The thing that sort of throws you a little bit is that, these classifiers, most of the data is the same for all of these classifiers. I mean, the first one leaves out sample one, the second one has sample one in it, but it leaves out sample two. So the data is the same, has the same n minus two things in it. It's just that that one is different. And so intuitively you wonder, does that make enough difference to, is it worthwhile doing this? Well, it turns out when you, leaving out one at a time, when you're using these very stringent significant levels for gene selection, has a lot of effect, surprisingly a lot of effect. And you might wonder, well, gee, why can't I just do gene selection using all the data and then avoid it? But it turns out that that has a huge effect in biasing your results. So you have to do the whole classifier building for each of these training sets. And that's all that leave one out cross-validation is. You could, in addition to just calculating number of prediction errors, you could say, well, of the times it was in class one, how many times did I wind up predicting it was in class two? And we might call that the sensitivity. And of the times that it was in class two, how many times did I wind up calling it was in class one? And that would be the specificity for the class one prediction. So in addition to estimating misclassification rate, you can estimate in the same way sensitivity and specificity. So just to reinforce what we've said before, cross-validation is only valid if the test set is not used in any way in the development of the model. Using the complete set of samples to select genes violates this assumption and invalidates cross-validation. With proper cross-validation, the model must be developed from scratch for each leave-one-out training set, and this means feature selection must be repeated for each training set. And the cross-validated estimate of misclassification error is an estimate of the prediction error for the model fit using the specified algorithm to the full data set. That's the point I was making before. If you use cross-validation estimates of prediction error for a set of algorithms indexed by a tuning parameter and select the algorithm with the smallest cross-validated error estimate, you do not have a valid estimate of the prediction error of the selected model. I'll say a little bit more about that. But I think I'll say a little bit more about that a little later on, so let's just leave that subtle but important point for a few minutes. So here's a simulation we did several years ago to show the importance of reselecting the genes with each iteration of the cross-validation. So we just generated some random data, 14 specimens, log ratio measurements, simulated log ratio measurements on 6,000 genes. Everything was, all gene expression measurements were from a normal distribution with mean 0 and variance 1, and all the correlations were 0. And then we just, when we would generate these 6,000 genes for 14 specimens, we just arbitrarily considered the first 7 specimens to be class 1 and the last 7 class 2. And there was, you know, but the data was just random from the same distribution for class 1 and class 2. And we used this compound covariate predictor, which was we had developed, and it was very simple. And we just built it on, we would take the 10 most differentially expressed genes as measured by a t-statistic, and we would build this compound covariate predictor based on those 10 genes, and then we would do various things with that predictor. And one of the things we would do in the black arrow, the black bars, is we would identify those 10 genes with the highest absolute T values, T statistics, and build our, using all 14 samples, and we would build our compound covariate predictor. Remember, our compound covariate is just a linear combination of the T statistic times the expression level summed over the 10 genes. And we would classify the same 14 samples that we use for building the model and selecting the genes. And if we did that, And the height of the bar is just the proportion of these replications of the simulation that we got a given number of misclassifications. So this resubstitution method, that is, you select your genes and build your model on all 14 samples, the same data set, and then you classify those same 14 samples. That's called a resubstitution method. In something like 98% of the time, we would get zero classification errors. Remember, this was data in which there's no real difference between class 1 and class 2. And so you should be getting like 50% error rates. And so that resubstitution method is clearly wrong. And you could say, well, we only had 10 genes in our final model. Yeah, but they were selected from 6,000 genes. And so we were really in an overfitting situation. We can't think of it as a 10-gene, 14-sample situation. It's a 6,000-gene, 14-sample situation. And then the second thing we did with these bars cross-hatched to the northeast, southwest, we use all 14 samples to calculate the t-statistic to decide which 10 genes to include in these models. And then we would just do the leave one out cross-validation with those 10 genes. So we would leave one case out, and now with the remaining 13 cases, we'd recalculate the t-statistic and fit the compound covariate predictor and predict for the one we left out. We would do that 14 times, but we used all of the data at the start to restrict attention to just those 10 genes. And if you do that, it's almost as bad as not using cross-validation at all. You know, I think one time we get two errors, but most of the times, 90% of the time you get zero errors, and about 10% of the time you get one error, not the 50% that you should be getting. So it's sort of amazing. You would think, what's the difference between using all of the data versus using N-1 samples for selecting the genes? But it makes a lot of difference. And then the other one is what we call complete cross-validation, and that is where you repeat the whole thing 14 times. Each 14 times you calculate the t-statistics for all 6,000 genes, select the 10 with the highest absolute t-statistics, fit the compound covariate predictor and predict for the one you left out. And when you do that, you get the cross-hatch bars shown going northwest to southeast. And you can see, there's a couple of things to see. One is, the center of that distribution something wrong here. We can't have 20 misclassifications with 14 specimens. I think we must have done this simulation a couple of different times, one with 20 and one with 14, and I got the two descriptions mixed up. So there must have been 20 cases. So we're getting the center of the distribution at about... I can't have more misclassifications than I have. With this last case, you're getting it wrong about half the time, which is what you should be. And the other thing is, you're getting a broad distribution of your estimated misclassification rate. So you don't have a very precise estimate. Leave one out cross-validation is not giving you a precise estimate. of the error rate, but it's giving you essentially an unbiased estimate. You know, it's unbiased, it's centered around half of an error rate of about 0.5, but it's not precise, it's not, you know, it's very broad. But on the other hand, you know, we've got a very small sample size, and you're trying to use the data both for developing models and getting a fair estimate of the predictive accuracy. And the nature of the broadness, remember when I was first introduced cross-validation, I said that it seems like there's something right about it, and it seems like maybe there's something wrong about it. And the right about it is everything seems unbiased. Everything, you know, you're always using separate data for developing your model than for predicting, but these models are very correlated with each other because they have most of the data in common between them. Well, that correlation winds up giving a sort of a large variance of prediction. And so that accounts in part for the breadth of this distribution. Part of it is accounted for just in the fact that we have a small sample size here. But part of it is accounted for by the fact that there's a lot of correlation between these training sets. And some of the other methods of resampling try to do better than leave one out cross-validation by reducing that correlation. I used to hear this invalid criticism of cross-validation. It would say, I haven't heard it in a while. You say, well, you can always find a set of features that will provide perfect prediction for the training and test set. And that's true, but if you, what you have to, it has to, what you're getting from cross-validation, there has to be a well-defined algorithm for developing a classifier. And you have to apply that algorithm to like a training, you know. In other words, cross-validation is giving you an essentially unbiased estimate of the prediction error when you use that particular algorithm. So, and so the fact that there might always be some set of features that will provide perfect prediction for the training and test set is somewhat irrelevant. It's not a criticism of cross-validation. There's a lot of negative things said about cross-validations that when you really think about them critically, they're not valid criticisms. Published a paper with Ann Molinaro, who was one of my postdocs in bioinformatics, in which we did a fairly thorough evaluation of different resampling methods. Leave one out cross-validation and a whole bunch of other methods. And I've sort of summarized. That paper is on our website, and it was published in Bioinformatics. And I've just abstracted some stuff from that paper. And we did it with both simulated data and some real data. And the way we would do it with simulated data is we would generate training set with some, in this case, 40 cases, 5,000 genes, 10, you know, I think we would generate it in which some of the genes really were informative and the rest of them were noise genes. And generally we had a small number of genes that were informative and the rest of them were noise genes. And then we would we looked at different algorithms like leave one out, like linear discriminant analysis and CART and various things, and diagonal linear discriminant analysis, and then we would evaluate these various resampling methods. We would generate a data set. We would, since we were simulating things, we would know the true predictive accuracy of. Since then we'd build a model for that data set. Using diagonal linear discriminant analysis, and then for that model with the selected genes developed by that model, we would know its true accuracy because it was simulated experiment, And so we would be able to write down what the true was, and then we would have various kinds of resampling estimates. So in this case of simulated data, the true prediction error was 7.8%. The resubstitution estimate, you know, that's the estimate you give by not doing any kind of resampling at all, was 0.7%, so it's way too low. Leave one out cross-validation gave a prediction error estimate of about 9.2%. Pretty good, just a little bit higher, and there's the standard deviation. And we then did what we call what's called tenfold cross-validation, where you leave out a tenth of the sample, and you build your model on the other 90%, and then you predict for that 10% that you left out, and you repeat that 10 times, and you average those prediction estimates, error estimates. In this case, that did a little bit worse than leave one out cross-validation. And also five-fold cross-validation, where you leave out 20% of the sample. And split sample, where we would split it 50-50, half of this 40 cases, 20 of the cases were used to build the model, and the other 20 cases using for testing the model, gave a terrible error estimate of 34.5%, where the true, in other words, if we develop a model, remember, what are these things trying to estimate? They're trying to estimate, if we have an algorithm for developing a classifier, we are ultimately going to apply that algorithm to the full data set so that we have something that we can use in the future. And we want to estimate how, what's the accuracy of that model in the future. And now the reason the split sample estimates are way too high is because, like the split sample 1-to-1, it's only using 20 of the samples to build the model. And the fact that for this set of data at least, it can't build nearly as good a model with 20 samples as it can with 40 samples. And so the error estimate, and that's the nature of the bias here. Now, if instead of 40 cases, we had 400 cases, and we developed and we looked at the split sample, it would probably do okay. It would probably do fine. Because there's a point of diminishing returns in sample size for building classifiers. And you get to the point where you've built about as good a classifier as you can build, and more samples aren't going to help you a whole lot. And but with 20 cases, you haven't reached that point. And so when you have a small number of cases, that's what I'm saying, things like a split sample really give you an underestimate of the accuracy of your classifier that you can build using the full data set, an overestimate of the error. There's a thing called a 0.632 plus bootstrap, which sometimes performs very well and sometimes doesn't, depending on the nature of the data. For this simulated data, it did not perform very well. It way overestimates the error rate. If you look at leave one out cross-validation, you see the 0.092 is a little bit higher than the 0.078. Well, that is because it's building its classifiers based on 39 cases rather than 40. And when you use tenfold cross-validation, it's leaving out four cases at a time. And so its bias is a little bit higher. And five-fold cross-validation is a little bit higher.
Is model dependent? Say if you try a different model?
You get different results. I think with things like leave one out cross-validation, you don't get very different results. Leave one out cross-validation, we say, is almost unbiased, and by that I mean the only reason it's not unbiased, by God, if you did it right, is because it's using n minus 1 instead of n. And there's, in terms of unbiasedness, there is absolutely nothing else wrong with leave one out cross-validation, regardless of what you read. It can be, in this case, it actually didn't have any more variance, standard deviation, the other things. There are lots of cases where it has a much higher standard deviation than the other cases. And there are cases where tenfold cross-validation is better than leave one out cross-validation, because some cases it's not very biased and its standard deviation is smaller because the training sets are a little bit less correlated from each other. And in some cases, the 0.632 plus bootstrap does very well. Here, as you can see, its standard deviation is very small, but it's sort of a complicated method. And what it is when it does the bootstrap, it samples cases with replacement. It always winds up building its model on sets of 40 cases, but the cases are sampled with replacement, so some of the cases will appear in the training set multiple times, which is a little bit weird. But so having 40 cases is not as good as having 40 distinct cases. Now, on average, it has 63% of the cases are distinct. And it winds up, its error estimate is a weighted combination of the error estimate of the models where you predict for the ones that were not in that particular bootstrap sample. That's called the leave one out bootstrap. And you can get a certain error estimate that way, and it averages that error estimate with the resubstitution estimate. But the weight is also a complicated function of things. So I think it's a little hard to make generalizations. One of the problems is these bootstrap methods were not developed for situations where the number of predictors is much greater than the number of cases. And so some of the claims were originally made are not necessarily valid for this situation. And
because we have 63% distinct samples, so that expand by between the split sample 1-2-1 and 2-1, 2-2-1.
It actually, yes, there is a similarity there. Yeah. We, in the paper by Annette Molinaro, she does explore that and shows that without gene selection, those two things are very similar.
What is the algorithm? If I understand correctly, the split sample 1-to-1 is not the same as twofold cross validation, but the repeat split 1-to-1 is the same as twofold cross validation. Am I right?
Yeah, the split sample here is where you just the split sample here is where you just split it once, and twofold cross validation, right? Would be first you develop the classifier here and you predict there and then you reverse. Yeah, and that's not the same as the split sample here. Although I think if we did twofold cross validation, that would also be very highly biased. These are some results not with simulated data, but with some actual lymphoma data. And I won't go into the details of how we did this. Since it's not simulated data, you can say, well, how do you know what the true thing is? But what we did was we sampled, it was a fairly large data set, and we would sample some of it for model building and resampling. The large portion of it we would leave separately, and we would evaluate models on that. And that was a much larger portion of the data set, and our estimate there is what we call the true. So there's more variability here. Here, I guess all of the methods did pretty well. the split sample 1-to-1 is still a little bit high. Here we're just listing the bias, but the biases are pretty small. And you can see the standard deviation here, the 0.632 plus bootstrap. Its bias is very small. It's actually smaller than for leave one out cross validation, and its standard deviation is very small. So it actually did the best of any of the methods for this lymphoma data. And here's, here's a little bit more on the simulated data. We had tenfold cross validation. And then we had repeated tenfold cross-validation. That is, rather than using just randomly splitting the data into 10 portions, each containing 10%, and leaving one of those portions out one at a time, after we would do that, we would repeat the whole process a large number of times to see, maybe that partition, that 10-way partition we got randomly was not a good partition by chance or something. So if we repeat it, and as you can see, when you repeat it, repeated tenfold, well, the estimate is about the same, but the standard deviation is somewhat lower. So by repeating these cross-validation partitions, you can reduce the standard deviation somewhat. Of course, with leave one out cross-validation, you can't repeat it. It's always the same end things. Here, with the split sample, you can also, rather than just splitting it once and training it here and testing it here, you could actually repeat that. I think we repeated it 10 or 100 times. We didn't make it into a two-fold cross-validation doing it symmetrically, but we repeated it. We repeated the split. And that actually made quite a bit of difference in terms of the standard deviation. Did want to mention, what you get, you have some kind of a classifier that has with it some kind of a gene selection process, and you can apply that to your data. And one, you can apply it to your full data set and get yourself a classifier to use for the future. Two, you can use one of these resampling methods, say cross-validation, and get a cross-validated error estimate. And so suppose you do that and you get a cross-validated error estimate of, say you have 40 samples and you get a cross-validated error estimate of 10 errors out of 40. Is that good? Well, that's 25% error rate. It's not great. You might ask, is it better than I would get if I flipped a coin? In other words, is it better than just random guessing? One way of answering that question is to randomly permute the class labels. In other words, shuffle which specimen goes with which class, and repeat that whole procedure and then do that 1,000 times so that you have a distribution of cross-validated misclassification rates for random data. And then see where does the 25% you actually had in your real, with the real data and real labels, where does that lie in the tail of that distribution or what? So you can get a test the to test whether your cross-validated misclassification rate is better than what you could do by chance through that permutation test. And BRBOA tools that does this for you as an option. Okay, I think I have a little example here. This was a very old example. I think this was the first study I ever got involved in. It was a very small example. We had 7 BRCA1 mutated tumors and 8 BRCA2 mutated tumors and 7 sporadic tumors. And we had 3,226 genes. And this was done with Jeff Trent and Mike Bittner, their group. And depending upon what kind of an alpha level we used for gene selection, you know, that would affect how many significant genes we had. If we used 0.01, we'd have 182 significant genes. Now, so if we did, if we were using, I think, the compound covariate predictor back then, and if we used 0.01 for our gene selection criteria as part of the development of this compound covariate predictor, if we were trying to predict BRCA1 versus non-BRCA1, where we lumped together the BRCA2s and the sporadics, so we had 22 cases, and we would have 3 misclassified. And if we did this permutation test of is that better than chance, 3 out of 22 misclassified, it was 0.004, I guess, was our significance level, 0.4%. So it's a number of random permutations with 3 or fewer misclassifications, but it's misclassifications from going through this cross-validation procedure. So there's a lot of calculations involved in that. And in this case, if you're more and more stringent with regard to gene selection, you do a little bit better and better. When we did the same thing with BRCA2 versus mutated versus not BRCA2 mutated, we didn't do better as we got, you know, more and more stringent. And I don't think there's any hard and fast rule as to whether it depends on how differentially expressed the informative genes really are, and it also depends on what your sample size is. We do have some information about what your threshold for gene selection should be in this new paper that Kevin Dobbin and I have on sample size for classifier determination. And BRB Array Tools does let you use the alpha as a tuning parameter, and it will it'll do a nested cross-validation with the selection of the optimal alpha on an inner loop and then cross-validate the model selected using that optimized tuning parameter to give you a fully cross-validated estimate of your...
Is it always the case that the number of significant genes have less number of significant genes?
Yeah.
Then always the random permutation is higher, even with the same misclassification elements.
I'm sorry. The number of misclassifications?
The same for the 0.01 and the 0.0001. The first row and the third row.
The third row?
Both are 4 misclassifications, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the random permutation is 0.8 and 6.6.
Right.
They depend on the number of genes. And the previous example is also like the 3 misclassifications and 1 misclassification. The random permutation is 3 and 2. You know.
Yeah, but what is the question?
Whether the random permutation p-value is dependent on the number of significant...
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, the last column... Oh, does it depend...
It should ought to be, right?
Well, in other words, when you do the percent of random permutations with M or fewer misclassifications, you're applying the algorithm, and the algorithm is for that particular alpha. So when we do these random permutations, and then we go through the whole cross-validation procedure, each step of that cross-validation procedure, we define a classifier based on an alpha of 10 to the minus 2. So I don't think there's any generalized pattern. You know, as you get more and more stringent, I don't think that there's. Yeah, I don't think so. And actually, if we use that BRCA2 data, this actually table was in, we have this book on design and analysis of DNA microarray experiments. It's published by Springer. This example was in it. So the compound covariate predictor, this is for BRCA2 versus non-BRCA2, gave, I think, a 14% error rate. Is that right? I think it was 4 out of 22 or something like that. And Fisher linear discriminant analysis, at least the way we were doing it, gave a very high error rate, I think because we were trying to estimate too many. There were too many significant genes, at least for the alpha we had used, and so it gave, trying to estimate all those correlations gave poor results. Diagonal linear discriminant analysis gave 14%. One nearest neighbor did a little bit better. And class, the single classification tree did very badly. Some of the common problems with classifier validation, as we've said before, pre-selection of genes using the entire data set is a problem. Failure to consider optimization of a tuning parameter as part of a classification algorithm, as I had just mentioned, that's a common problem. We have a paper with my postdoc Sudhir Varma and I in the recent issue of BMC Bioinformatics on that. And the other thing is erroneous use of the predicted class in a regression model. See, I think I may have another, I don't know if I have another slide on that, but one of the things you sometimes see is people do leave one out cross validation and then they try to, and they predict a class or something like that for samples, and then they want to use that in, say, a multivariate logistic model to see are those predictions independent from the predictions you would get with standard clinical covariates, or what? How do they relate to standard clinical covariates? And sort of, but it's not really valid to take the predicted class, even from validation, and use that in some multivariate regression model, because the predictions are not independent. They are each sort of an unbiased thing. Each were developed using a model that didn't include the thing you're predicting for, but because they're not. Because they're not independent, you really can't use them in those kind of models. It's the same thing like with this, why did we go through this permutation distribution? This is a lot of computation. Why not just say, well, we had so many prediction errors in so many samples, why can't we just refer to a binomial distribution? And that the reason we can't, the reason that's not valid is because those predictions are not independent, because the training sets are highly correlated, and consequently the number, these are not independent Bernoulli processes, and so the number of prediction errors is not binomial, and so you can't, it's not really valid to use binomial confidence intervals or to test whether it came from a binomial distribution of P of 1/2. And it's the same reason why it's not really valid to use those predicted classes in a multivariate logistic model.
So how do you see the integration of any of this genomic information with traditional predictors?
We'll get to that. So publications are using all the data to select. Yeah, I think we've said this many times. Incorrect cross validation. Suppose let M be a classification model developed on a set of data D where the model is of a particular type that is parameterized by some parameter B. Suppose we use cross validation to estimate the classification error of a model developed based on data D with some kind of tuning parameter B. And suppose we do that for a whole grid of B values. In other words, B could be the P threshold we use for gene selection. And we do it for a P of 0.05 and 0.01 and 0.005 and 0.001. And for E. And we redo the gene selection and the fitting of diagonal linear discriminant models, say, for each of using these various different threshold alpha levels for gene selection. And for each time we go through the rigmarole and we get a leave one out cross-validated prediction error estimate. Okay, so that's what ERR of B is. It's the cross-validated prediction error estimate when we use tuning parameter value B. Okay, now caution. ER, and let's let B squared be the value that minimizes ERR of B. So it is the value of the tuning parameter for which our cross-validated prediction error is smallest. Caution, ERR of B squared is a bias estimate of the prediction error of the model based on B star and D. This is sort of a subtle point, but it can be important. It's just that suppose our tuning parameter is a nonsense parameter. It doesn't really affect anything at all. Suppose that in our model development procedure, there's a certain random element. I don't think there actually is a random element here, but suppose there were. Well, for example, if we're doing it based on tenfold cross-validation, I guess there's a random element as to how we randomly split the things up into ten partitions. So for the different values of B, we may get somewhat different values of this error estimate. And if we then pick the value of B for which the error estimate is smallest, and then use the error estimate at that value of B, we started off by saying B doesn't affect anything, but we've got this random effect and we've picked the smallest value of it, and now we think we've got a value of B that's better than all the other values of B, but we've introduced bias. We don't have is that a reasonable way of picking a value of the tuning parameter? Yes, it is a reasonable way of picking the value of the tuning parameter. However, we don't actually have an unbiased estimate of the model based on that. And so if we want to get an unbiased estimate of that model, we have to consider the selection of B star as part of our algorithm and embed the entire algorithm within a cross-validation. Okay, I don't want to spend too much time on it. This is sort of this nested cross-validation. It sort of just outlines how you do the nested cross-validation. But I do want to get to a little bit about the sample size, so let's maybe move on.
So whenever there's a natural time to break, we do have a break scheduled.
Okay, let's see. Let's just get to where we start on the sample size. And then we're breaking for how long?
Just 15 minutes.
Okay. Here, does an expression profile classifier predict more accurately than standard prognostic factors? This is not really an issue of which variables are significant after adjusting for which others, or which are independent predictors, which is usually the statistical sort of answer for if you have these predictors, you have those predictors. And so you say, well, if I include the standard prognostic factors, this thing is still significant. And that's usually the answer that people give. But we didn't actually ask whether it was significant. I mean, you may be interested in whether it's significant, but what we really want to know is how important is it and how much does it help prediction accuracy. And so one of the things you could do is you could just look at a classifier based on your standard covariates, your standard clinical covariates or whatever they are, and then you could build a classifier based on expression profiles. And then you could just see, you could just, that will give you an estimate of the classification accuracy of both of them, or you could be a little, you can break that down into sensitivity and specificity, or you can actually break it down even more into trying to cross-validate the ROC curve as a function of the threshold for classification you use. All of these things will give you estimates of sort of predictiveness of the two different approaches. Or the other thing, it won't really give you a measure of statistical significance of the difference between those two. You can take your standard prognostic factors and form strata, high risk, low risk strata, and then develop expression profile classifiers within each of those strata and evaluate the statistical significance of the predictive accuracy of the expression profile classifiers within each of those two strata, within each of the strata, however many strata you have. And I think that's sort of the ideal thing to do if you have enough data, in the sense of it gets at, are the expression profile, are they useful for the high risk patients? Are they useful for the low risk patients? Is it significantly useful? And what's the size of the? How much can you break up the low risk patients, and how much better can you predict for them and for the high risk patients? So, anyway, this is sort of.
You could also combine these.
You could have a combined classifier, yeah. In other words, you could, I think actually with the new version of BRB Array Tools, we have a survival risk prediction tool, and the new version will permit you to develop combined clinical and expression-based, and it actually selects the genes. If you do the combined, it selects genes based univariately, but not really univariately. Do they add to the clinical covariates that you've already included?
How do you do that if these lines of value said that you cannot combine them into
a model? Well, the way we'll do it, it actually won't give you a measure of statistical significance of the combined classifier versus the classifier based only on the clinical covariates. I'd have to think more about how you would do that. It will give you a classifier that uses the clinical covariates and expression covariates, and it'll give you estimates of predictive accuracy for those. But it won't give you a measure of whether that model is statistically significantly better than the other model. Now, I'm not sure.
Using permutation, couldn't you get a distribution of the
error? Yeah, that's, you probably could.
And
that's
then
right.
You compare what you're observed by classifier error is against that permutation distribution.
You probably
about the overall model anyway.
Yeah. So with your original data, you'll get a predictiveness for the standard model, a predictiveness for the model with the standard covariates and your expression variables, and you'll have some measure of increment, a reduction in error,
right,
of those two things. And you would then permute the labels and have to think about that. That sounds like
all over again.
Yeah. And then you would permute the labels and to see I You know, the thing I'm a little worried about in that, I'd have to think about it, where these problems get very sticky is even the clinical, once you permute the labels, the clinical covariates are no longer prognostic. And so what happens when you really think about it, you know, when you realize that, you realize, well, wait a minute, what am I really trying to estimate? And you realize that, I've thought about this somewhat before, and what I've come to the conclusion is that when you say, is this combined model significantly better than the other model, that's actually not a well-defined question.
Yeah, you need some exchangeability
problem. Yeah. And is it significantly better? It only has meaning in some model-dependent sort of way, and so I'm not sure you really can get at it with permutations. And unfortunately, I don't think you can get at it in the standard sort of way people have gotten at it. And so there needs. So I don't know really what the answer is at this point in time.
Cross-validation, and they claim to have 100% successful rate. The problem I feel like is, and take a look, they have only 6 samples in total, 3 in class A, 3 in class B. So, and my gut feeling is, it seems not that significant to me. So what's your interpretation of this?
I think it wouldn't be at all surprised that they would have an estimate of zero errors, but with a small sample size like that, that's probably not any different. It's not significantly different than flipping a coin.
Is that the case? How can you claim 4 is large enough or 5 is large enough? Where would you draw the line?
Well. In other words, if you do this permutation test, it'll tell you. I mean, it'll say of all of the possible, if you permute the labels in all the possible ways, where is your zero? You know, what percentage of the random permutations have a zero? And you'll find, well, it's 20% of them. And so it'll automatically, yeah. I think. Okay, let me just have this one thing on external validation, and then I think we'll take our break. And then at the end, I'll talk a little bit about survival risk group prediction and then the sample size stuff. So just the external validation, in other words, there's a lot of controversy about what is proper validation of a expression, you know, based classifier. I tend to think of it in terms of internal versus external. We have to, external is usually very expensive and a really lot of effort. And new study, possibly a prospective study, possibly a multi-center study, maybe big money involved. And so you need an internal estimate to know whether it's even worthwhile to think about that kind of thing. On the other hand, it's nice to bear in mind, I like the distinction between internal and external, even if sometimes you can't do the external, because it reminds you of what is it that you haven't really considered and maybe can't consider in your own study, and that is clinical utility. You can predict which diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patients are going to respond to CHOP-B chemotherapy and which ones aren't. You don't do it perfectly, but you have a good predictor. Does that have clinical utility? I would think not. Because this is a potentially curative therapy. There's no other known curative therapy. There's experimental therapies. And so your classifier had better have a very good negative predictive value for anybody to use this, because if it predicts that they're not going to be cured, there's actually nothing much else for them to take. So so clinical utility is very different than predictive accuracy. And when you start talking about taking something further with external validation, I think generally you're starting to talk about evaluating clinical utility. Also, there's probably a lot of sources of variability involved in broad clinical application that you have not been able to address in your study. You may have done your expression profiling in your laboratory of all of these tissues over a relatively short period of time. There may be assay drift, reagent change over time, and so just the assaying itself may be different, and particularly if you're talking about using this assay in some other laboratory, they'll be different. Tissue handling, these are RNA-based assays, very sensitive to handle it, to getting the tissue frozen quickly. And lurking prognostic factors that are existing in one center but not some other center. So there are, until you have real external validation. And of course, a lot of times, how can you even have real external validation? A lot of the classifiers that people develop, if you actually look at the paper, the classifier isn't actually in the paper. So if you wanted to take, in some of these cases, somebody else's classifier and see it if it validated with your patients, you couldn't actually do it. They may list their genes that they found, but the classifier itself a lot of times isn't even there. And and of course there are issues of platform differences, and if you're talking about broad clinical application, there's a question of, are you going to really use microarrays at all? Are you going to translate it to sort of an RT-PCR type of platform? Are you going to use protein expression? So there's a lot of issues in terms of really clinical translation that it's not to minimize the importance of doing proper internal validation, but there are other issues involved that beyond your control. Okay, well, let's take our break, and then when we come back, we'll talk, like I say, a little bit